yesterday we started talking about quantum information, just in terms of the kind of states and operations that we can do on quantum states and some basic quantum protocols that we can implement to sort of get the idea that we can use quantum mechanical systems to represent and process information. And so what we're going to do today is to start to move toward the idea that we can use quantum systems really to do computations and ultimately to solve problems that seem to be harder to solve with classical computers. So there are some problems we can solve a lot faster using quantum algorithms than we could using classical algorithms. So I'm going to introduce the notion of a circuit model, which is the model that we usually use to formalize quantum computation. It's quite convenient. I'll talk about the notion of reversible computation, which is a completely classical thing, but which is essential to understand if you want to do quantum computation. And then I'll talk about the notion of universality, which you saw a little bit of a preview of in yesterday's tutorial. And I'll talk about the general scenario of trying to do universal quantum gates acting on a large system of many qubits, whereas in this problem in the tutorial, you just looked at what happens when you're acting on a single qubit. Okay. So what are circuits, and what is this circuit model, and why are we interested in doing this? Well, the basic reason that we want to think about computations in terms of circuits, or at least in terms of some concrete model consisting of some simple discrete operations, is that we would like to quantify how hard it is to solve certain problems. And so we need a model in which we can say what are basic operations, what are things that are easy to do, and then if we describe some complex computation that involves many elementary operations, we can just count up the elementary operations, and then that gives us some measure of complexity. So let me write something about that. So circuits decompose a potentially complex algorithm into elementary components. And if we count up the gates, that tells us how hard it is to do the computation. So count the gates to measure complexity. OK, and now this notion of a circuit model is something which is already used in classical computation. So let me start from there. Probably you're familiar with this idea of classical logic gates, but let me just kind of introduce the basic idea just to have somewhere to start. So classically, the way we usually think about a circuit model of computation, which would be one way of thinking about how we would build a computer, of course, there are other models we might use to model classical computation, such as Turing machines, which you've probably heard about, or other sorts of notions of computation. But circuits are one particularly convenient model. So what we would do is we would consider gates like, for example, the AND gate. What does the AND gate do? Well, it takes as input two bits. So x and y here would be either 0 or 1. And then it outputs some single value, which is the logical AND of x and y. So the output is 1 if and only if both of the inputs are 1. Okay. So we could do gates like that. And the idea is that we'll think about our basic gates as just consisting of operations like this that act on a constant number of bits. So if we have some computation that involves n bits, where n is some potentially arbitrarily large integer, we won't allow n-bit operations just as to count just as single operations. We'll have to build them up out of simple gates, maybe 1 and 2-bit gates, or maybe also we'll allow some 3-bit gates. But there'll be some constant which says the largest number of gates that are involved in any one elementary gate that we can use as a basic operation in the circuit. Okay. And now, if we can think about a set of gates that we're going to use as the basic gates that we build our computation out of, they should have a property, which is that they should be universal. So if we want it to be the case that we could, at least in principle, do any computation that could be done, we would like to have some set of gates that allows that. So we want our gate set to be universal. And what that means in this classical context, we'll talk about quantum universality later on, but what it means in this classical context is that you should, in principle, be able to compute any function. Okay, so we can compute any function that maps bits to bits, because we have this idea that without loss of generality, we think about representing information using bits. So we can compute any function from 0, 1 to the n to 0, 1 to the m. Okay, so we have some, you know, size n for our input space, some size m for our output space, and we would like to be able to compute any function that maps bits to bits. Okay, so we would like to have a universal set of gates, and maybe you know that there are some kind of simple sets of operations that are universal. So here's a common one. So there's the NOT gate, which takes as inputs some bit and outputs the negation of x, so it sends 0 to 1, 1 to 0. The AND gate, I just explained what it is over here. The OR gate, which takes as inputs two bits, x and y, and I think the usual symbol for this is something like this, and then outputs the logical OR of x and y. So not the exclusive OR, but just the logical OR. If either or both of the bits are 1, then the output is 1. And there's actually one more thing that you need that sometimes is sort of not actually counted, but it is important, and that's what's called fan-out. And when we talk about quantum computing, you'll see that this is sort of not a completely trivial thing. So fan-out is just a gate that copies a bit. So this is something that takes as input one bit and then you know, takes as output two bits. And I suppose you could also allow a gate that just discards bits. But if you have bits that you're not actually using at the end of the computation, maybe you can just ignore them you know, implicitly and not worry about having some gate that does that. So if we just consider these four gates, the NOT gate, the AND gate, the OR gate, and the fan-out gate, this is a universal set. This allows us to, in principle, compute any function from bits to bits. And you know, this is a universal set, but we could come up with other universal sets. There's no particular reason to choose any one universal set, but we would like to have some set which is universal in order to think about computation. So you know, we could, in particular for this set, we could simplify it further. For example, the OR gate is not needed. So something you could show, I mean, this is basically what's called De Morgan's laws. Probably you've seen this before. There's a way to express what the OR gate does just in terms of the NOT gate and the AND gate. And in fact, an even simpler, so it's possible to have a universal set that consists of just two gates. So another one would be just what's called the NAND gate. So this is just the negation of the AND gate. So that's sometimes drawn like this. These symbols are not important, but we're not going to use them later on, but I'm just showing them here to have some picture of what's going on. So this is the negation of the AND of the two inputs, and then the fan out. So if we have just these two gates, this actually already gives us a universal set. And this is something that you can think about if it's sort of not obvious to you why it's the case. Okay, so this is the way we usually think about computation classically in terms of gates. But actually, there's a bit of a problem with this way of thinking about computation if we want to move toward quantum computation. And actually, even if we just sort of think about the physics of computation, there's already an issue with these set of gates that may seem a little bit funny, which is that in general these gates are not reversible, right? So note, these gates can be irreversible. So what I mean by that is, you know, if you think about this circuit that's drawn here as some kind of space-time diagram that's, you know, turned on its side, you know, you have coming in some bits, and then, you know, they interact somehow in the gate, and then there's some bit coming out. But you can't, in general, run the picture backward, right? I mean, if you just know what the output is, you can't infer what the input was. So from the, you know, say from the AND of two bits, x and y, there's no way to infer what both of x and y are, right? Information has been lost, right? So for example, we can't infer, you know, the pair xy from x and y. Okay, but on the other hand, physics is reversible, right? All the, you know, basic laws of physics are reversible. So this seems a little bit strange, right? It seems like somehow, you know, the set of basic operations that we're considering as, you know, the operations that any computation would be built out of are ones that it seems like don't really respect a kind of basic principle of the laws of physics. Now, of course, this is not really a problem because you could imagine that the reason that these gates are irreversible is because, you know, they're done by an interaction with some other system that's then discarded. So there could be some explanation for where the irreversibility comes from in an implementation of these gates. I mean, of course, we know how to actually build these gates in some, in some implementation. So it's not there can't be something fundamentally wrong. But on the other hand, it should be possible, at least in principle, to do computation in a completely reversible way. And so that's what we're going to see next. And this is important because when we want to talk about quantum computation, we want to talk about a computation that involves pure quantum states. And the evolutions that map pure quantum states to pure quantum states are unitary transformations. And those are reversible transformations, right? You can always invert a unitary matrix. You just take its adjoint, and that's its inverse. And so if we want to build up a quantum circuit model where the gates correspond to unitary transformations, which is what we're going to do, it's essential that the operations in particular can be made to be reversible. So let's see how we can do that using okay, that's not quite what I wanted, but I guess we'll work with that. Okay, so let's see how we can do that using, first of all, just using classical information. So we're going to have classical bits, and we're going to consider reversible transformations that that just act on classical bits, and we'd like to have some notion of a universal set of reversible gates for classical computation. So so we can make reversible versions of classical gates. And there's a basic, very simple trick for doing this, which is that we just think about keeping the input around, right? So the problem with the AND gate, when you, compute the AND of X and Y, the fact that you can't recover X and Y, would certainly be, that problem would just go away if you just remembered what X and Y were. Right? I mean, if you keep x and y as part of the output, then you can always go back to the input. So on the other hand, you have to be careful to have the map go from bits to bits in the right way so that it actually is reversible. And a way of doing that for the AND gate is as follows. So this is what's called the Toffoli gate. And you should think about this as a reversible AND gate. That's one maybe reasonable way to think about it. And the way we normally draw this in a circuit picture, which starts to sort of get toward the sort of circuit diagrams that we'll be writing when we write down quantum circuits, is as follows. So we'll draw wires that carry, in this case, just classical bits, and much as we did when we drew those pictures. But now we're going to have a reversible operation, so the number of output wires will always be the same as the number of input wires, right? Because, of course, to have a reversible transformation on bits, you can't throw any bits away. You have to always have the size of the output space be the same as the size of the input space, right? If you have a bijection between two sets, those two sets have to have the same size. So the way we would draw this Toffoli gate is like this. And this is kind of an extended version of this controlled NOT gate that we saw briefly yesterday. And what it would do, so the way it would behave is as follows. So if both x and y, so here's where the AND comes from, if both x and y are 1, then we flip the bit z. But if either of the bits x or y are 0, then we don't flip the bit z. So a way of writing that is that the output here is just so z plus mod 2, so this means addition modulo 2. That's the same thing that's written here. So this is addition mod 2. So plus x and y. Okay. And then what we do with the bits x and y is we just also make them part of the output. So here we have x, y. Okay. So we keep the input around. We keep x and y around, but we also have the AND of x and y sitting over here if we were to initialize z to 0. Right? So what this does is if we add 0 mod 2, then we just get x and y. And if we add 1 mod 2, then we just get the negation of x and y. Okay. So we can use this in particular to implement an AND gate. Right? So we do that by setting this ancilla bit to 0. So then we have a picture that looks like this. So this would then be x and y, and here we have x and y. Okay, but the circuit is defined. I mean, the gate is defined even if the bit z happens to not be 0. Even if it's 1, the output over here is defined, and it's defined in such a way that, of course, the transformation is reversible. Okay, so this is what you should think of as a reversible AND gate. Okay, but now I claim that actually this is not just a reversible AND gate. It has other functionality built into it. There are other things that you can do with this gate. And in fact, you can actually do a universal set of gates using only this gate. So if you want to do a reversible computation, universally, it suffices to actually only have one gate in your gate set, and that's this gate. So can you see how you can do that? Maybe somebody can tell me how you can implement other functionality that you need. Yes?
If you initialize the ancilla to 1, you get a NAND gate.
So what do you mean by the ancilla? Oh, you're saying the bit Z.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's true. So that's one way of seeing it. So that's something you would need to do. So if you take here x, y, 1, then this would be the not and x, y. So you use this word ancilla. I mean, I'll say something about that in a second, but well, maybe I'll say something about that now. So sometimes when we're doing some computation, we'll have some bits which are not involved in the input or the output, and we just set them, well, they're either not involved in the input or not involved in the output, and we just set them to some value and then use them in the course of the computation. And such bits are called ancilla bits or sometimes workspace bits. So I think what you're saying is, we set this bit to 1, we're not actually using it as part of the input. We are, of course, using the output for that bit. So we're thinking about this, at least as far as the input is concerned, as some ancilla bit. Okay. So that's good. So now we can do a NAND gate, but is that enough? I mean, it's not enough, right? Because I said also you have to have fan-out to be universal, right? So if you just have NAND gates and you don't have the ability to copy the input, you may actually not be able to do a universal set. So is there some way that you can do a fan-out operation using the NAND gate? Yes, exactly. So this is NAND. And what you said is, suppose we set y to be, we should set y to be 1, right? Because we want this thing to always fire. But yeah, basically. So here we have x, 1, and 0. So now we initialize 2 of our input bits to fixed values. And now this gives us a fan-out gate. So this is going to give us x, 1, and here we'll get x if we put that input. Right, so we should think about this as implementing fan-out. And so now we have a universal set. It's also easy to see how you would do a NOT gate, say, just by setting these two bits to 1. So, taking this and that NOT gate and the fan-out gate, that would be another way to see it. Okay, so this Toffoli gate on its own is universal. So that says if you want to do any computation, in principle, you can do it reversibly. You just take, you figure out how to represent the computation using, say, NAND and fan-out gates. And then you just do some translation where every time you see a NAND gate, you use this. And every time you see a fan-out gate, you use this. And so the size of the circuit will be, the size of the reversible circuit will be, basically the same. It will use the same number of gates as you would need using NAND and fan-out gates. And maybe you'll need a few more bits because sometimes, for example, when you do a fan-out gate, you need 2 bits that that you wouldn't otherwise need in the input of the the basic fan-out gate. But you don't need too many more bits. You just need maybe some constant factor more bits lying around when you're doing the computation. So that's nice because it says that in principle we can do any computation reversibly just by doing some gate-by-gate replacement. Okay. So one thing maybe to notice is that if you look at this fan-out operation where you're setting this bit equal to 1, basically what you're doing is turning this Toffoli gate into a controlled NOT gate, right? So if we have here x and 0, well, if we were just to have y, and here we set this equal to 1, here we'll get x and 1 and this is going to do the controlled NOT, right? So it's going to be x plus y, right? So this is doing a CNOT, right? So this is the the same thing as taking here x and y and just doing a C naught. So you can think about this controlled NOT gate as sort of a reversible fan-out operation, right? If y is equal to 0, then it just copies things. And if y is equal to 1, then it puts the negation of x over here. So C naught you should think of as, at least from the standpoint of classical bits, you should think about it as a reversible fan-out operation. Yeah, I'll write that. OK. So now there's something which is which is useful to see about this kind of gate-by-gate simulation that I indicated that allowed you to take any computation that you could do classically using elementary logic gates and turn it into a reversible implementation of that circuit, which is that, of course, in general, when you do that, you will have some junk lying around in the output. So let me maybe draw a picture of that. So a general reversible circuit has junk in the output. So what will it look like? So first of all, we'll have a bunch of input bits. Let me call them x1 through xn. So these would be the bits oh, yes, question?
How exactly is the C0 sort of a reversible fan out?
Well, if you set the bit y equal to 0, then it's exactly fan out. It's a sort of a reversible generalization of fan out. I mean, it's a reversible fan out gate in the same sense that the Toffoli gate, if you consider all of its possible inputs, is a reversible AND gate. It's sort of analogous. Yes.
I can see why AND is a reversible because if you know x and y, you get x and y.
Right.
So why is fan out not reversible?
Ah, well, what if you try to run it backwards where the two bits are not equal? Right, like. It just doesn't make sense, right? So you can't, in general, you can't have a reversible operation where the input and output spaces are not the same because, there just can't be a bijection between the input and output spaces.
The gate has to accept any input.
Right, right. I mean, if you somehow forced it, if you somehow allowed yourself to impose restrictions on the form of inputs to gates, then you could have some notion of reversibility. And, sometimes we think about operations like that. For example, when we talk about, in quantum information, sometimes we talk about isometries that map some spaces to other spaces, and that they're sort of the quantum analog of this. So sometimes notions like this are useful, but what I would demand here is that to really be reversible, you would have to accept any input. Yeah. OK, sorry, other questions? OK, so in general, if we do some reversible computation, there's going to be junk in the output. So what's that going to look like? Well, here's our input. And then we're going to have some space in which we're going to eventually write the output. So this is the input register. This is the output register. We initialize it to 0, but eventually we're going to want to actually write the output there. And then we'll also have some workspace or some ancilla bits that just correspond to places that we're going to store intermediate results of computations. So like, for example, maybe we don't actually need the NAND of x and y as part of our final output, but we need to compute it as an intermediate step. And then this bit would belong to this next block of bits I'm going to talk about. So let's say that we initialize those to 0. Depending upon which gate set you consider, that might be with or without loss of generality. I mean, here, sometimes we need to have bits that are initialized to 1 in order to make things work. We could throw in a NOT gate, which is a reversible gate, so that we wouldn't need to do that. So just to make things simple, let's imagine that we start out by initializing all the workspace bits to 0, and then maybe we have the possibility to do a NOT gate if we want to flip one of them to 1. So this is the workspace. And then what's going to happen? Well, we're going to do some big reversible circuit, which I'm just going to draw as a box. So this is some circuit C, consisting of, say, Toffoli and NOT gates. So this is something that allows us to implement some reversible computation. And then at the end of the day, what's going to happen? Well, remember, we always keep our input around. So these input bits x1 through xn will be unchanged by the computation. But then we'll have some output, y. So say there are m bits here. So this is our output. And that's where the you know, final answer of the computation is written. But then we also will have accumulated junk in the course of doing computation. I mean, it's the intermediate results of, you know, things we wanted to compute along the way. So let's write that here. So this is like J1 through JK. So we have K bits, you know, which could be a very large number of bits that we've used to store the results of intermediate computations. Okay. All right, so this, you know, this is maybe not so satisfying because we have all of these junk bits lying around. And, you know, this is somehow wasted space, right? If we wanted to go on and do more computation, we might need some bits that were initialized to known values, you know, that were initialized to zeros, or maybe that were initialized to ones. And, you know, these bits now are in some values that depend on what computation took place, so we can't use them as fresh bits for workspace. And actually, you know, when we get to quantum computation, which we will very soon, there's an even bigger problem, which is that if we have this junk lying around, if we have junk that, you know, that distinguishes different outputs from each other, that may prevent interference. So, you know, quantum computation will be all about interference between different computational paths, allowing you to reach the result of some computation more quickly using this quantum interference than you would if you didn't have the ability to interfere different amplitudes. But if you have values sitting in this junk register, it could prevent this interference from taking place because you would have different junk corresponding to potentially the same computational result up here. And then the distinguishability of that junk would prevent your computational paths from interfering. And we'll see things like this in more detail later on. So for various reasons, we might like to not have the junk. And it turns out that fortunately, there's a simple way to get rid of the junk. Okay, so the junk bits can be uncomputed as follows. Okay, let's see if I can get this right now. So rear mid front. Brilliant. Okay, so we can uncompute these junk bits as follows. So first of all, we're going to run the circuit just the way it's computed there. So we'll have here x1 through xn and 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, so we run C. And now we would like to store the output. And so what we'll do is we'll have yet more bits that we'll introduce that we will use to store the values of the final result of the computation. So those bits will appear down here. So they'll initially be initialized to zero. And then what we'll do is we'll perform reversible copying. So we'll do this reversible fan-out operation in order to write the value. So, you know, here we have y1 through ym. And what we're going to do is we're going to copy those values down into these m fresh ancilla bits. So we'll take this one and write that value here. And we'll do that independently for each of these bits and write each of them down here somewhere in these bits at the bottom. Okay. And now what we can do in order to erase the junk, so you know these values here are in the values j1 through jk. So there are a bunch of bits that we would like to reset to zero. And we can do that by just running the inverse of the circuit C. And running the inverse of the circuit just means doing the inverses of each of the individual gates backward. And that's quite simple because notice the Toffoli gate is its own inverse, right? So every time we see a Toffoli gate, we actually just put the Toffoli gate also in the circuit over here, but we're running the circuit backwards in order to uncompute all of the junk. Okay, so now if we do this, what's going to happen? Well, all of these bits were set to the values y1 through ym, but now all of these bits were reset back to zero because that was their initial value, and we undid the computation. So, you know, these bits were unaffected when we looked at them to see what value to set here. So as far as these bits are concerned, it's just like we did C and then C inverse. Right? So when we do this, well, these bits will all remain in the values x1 through xn, but then these bits will all be set back to zero. Yes? No, we use a reversible operation and the fact that these things were initialized to zero. So the whole thing will define a reversible operation because it's also defined what would happen if we were to set some of these bits to one. Then what you would get over here would, of course, not be the y sub i's. You might get the negation of y sub I. Like if I set this bit equal to 1, instead of getting y1 here, I would get not y1. But it's what happens would be defined if I would set this equal to 1, and overall the whole circuit is reversible because, you know, so this whole thing consists of a product of permutation matrices, right? Every reversible gate corresponds to some permutation of the possible bit strings that the computer could be set to. And you know, here I do a bunch of permutations, and this also corresponds to some permutation. It just permutes the four possible bit strings that these two bits could be in some way. And so that's also a reversible operation. So I could reverse the whole circuit by doing again C, then doing these C not gates again because they're their own inverses, and then doing C inverse again, and that would actually reverse the whole circuit. Yeah. Okay. Good. Other questions? Okay, so this is a convenient trick, and what it means is the following. So the other thing to notice is that when we perform this circuit on this expanded set of bits, and we do these additional gates, we haven't actually done that many more gates, right? We've done twice as many gates. You know, we did C, and then we did its inverse, and the number of gates in C inverse is just the same as the number of gates in C. We just do them in the opposite order. So the number of gates in this whole circuit is just twice the number of gates in C plus m, right? Because we have to do these m C not gates. So if let me maybe just write that. So if C has t gates, then this circuit uses 2t plus m gates. So in other words, really not that many more gates, and it only involves m additional n syllables. So this is something, some kind of translation which we would say is efficient. Okay, so what this means is that any computation that maps x to some function of f, some function f of x as the output that can be done efficiently by a classical computer. Well, right now, what I mean is specifically that it can be done efficiently by some circuit consisting of, say, you know, AND, OR, NOT, and fan-out gates. But we'll see later on that roughly corresponds to it being done efficiently by any kind of reasonable notion of classical computation. So any computation like this that can be done efficiently can efficiently be done reversibly. Okay. Can be done efficiently by a reversible circuit. And there's sort of a standard form that we're using to say what we mean by the action of a reversible circuit to compute a function f. What it means is the following. So you take as input x and y and then a bunch of bits initialized to 0. And, well, okay, I guess actually maybe let me not include these because I want to define it in such a way that it's clear that this whole thing is a reversible transformation. So I guess in order to compute just f of x, you'll set these bits y to 0, but you know we'll define it in the case where they're not necessarily set to 0. So what this thing will do is it will map xy to x and then y plus f of x. And you know there may be some other bits that are around for the ride during the computation, and those bits will also be reset, and the computation will be reversible on the whole thing. But with possibly some small number of n syllables, you can always do this kind of a transformation reversibly. So what I mean by this, here each of these values is not just a single bit, but it's a whole register of bits. So this is n bits, and this is m bits. And when I write plus here, I mean bitwise addition modulo 2. So just each of the bits, each of the pairs of bits between y and f of x are individually added mod 2. So this is something where if you set y equal to 0, it just gives you the desired output f of x. And If you know, if you set y equal to 1, or you set this to some string other than the all zero string, then you'll get something more complicated over here. But you get something which is defined in such a way that it's always reversible. And in fact, this operation is its own inverse, right? Because if you were to add f of x here twice, you would just get back to y. OK. So this is reversible computation in a nutshell. So questions? Yes. Right. Well, you know, any computation is a physical process, right? I mean, this is sort of like, you know, one of the big motivations for quantum computing, right? So, I mean, the motivation for quantum computing being that every physical process is presumably a quantum mechanical process, right? So if we think about computation being a physical process, we should make use of quantum effects that we could to try to make the computation potentially go faster. And you know, if physics in principle is reversible, we should be able to think about computation in a reversible way, because computation is a physical process. I mean, anything that we can think about doing in the real world should be a physical process.
So I think, you know, it's reassuring that we can prove that we can do any of these computations reversibly, but is there, beyond wanting that reassurance, is there some reason to do the computation reversibly?
Yeah, there is a practical reason, which is that so if you could do if you chose to do computation reversible, in principle you could do it without dissipating energy, right? So you know, you have to, if you do a computation, it costs a lot of energy to run the computer, and the computers that we, you know, that we actually use now are not reversible computers, and you know, that's part of the reason that they get hot. And of course it's not the only reason, but you know, the fact there's some sort of energy cost which is associated with doing computation irreversibly. But if you do computation reversibly, in principle you can do it without dissipating energy. Now, to truly dissipate no energy, you have to compute arbitrarily slowly, and you know, so that's one of the reasons that we don't compute reversibly in practice. But there are practical reasons to try to do it. But I guess probably those reasons are not too practical, because we're not, you know, people aren't rushing to try to build reversible computers. So the real motivation for us is that we want to think about quantum computation. And when we think about quantum computation, it will be reversible. And so you know, first we want to understand what we can say about classical reversible computation. And that was a great segue into the next thing that we're going to talk about, which is, you know, what happens when we bring quantum mechanics into the mix. Okay, so now, you know, we could think about this whole computation being actually a quantum computation, and basically nothing changes. We just put kets around everything. So so we can consider reversible circuits to be quantum circuits just add kets. Okay. And if we do this, we immediately see that, you know, anytime we had some function f of x that we know how to compute efficiently with a classical computer, we could compute that on a quantum computer in the sense of, you know, in the sense of this. So what we would say is that we can efficiently implement, you know, quantum operations of the form so we have x, y goes to x, y plus f of x, bitwise mod 2. So whenever f is an efficiently computable function. So for efficiently computable f. And we'll be doing things like this quite a bit when we talk about quantum algorithms. Yes? So what I mean by this is that we're going to consider a computation that consists of operations acting on quantum states. Those quantum states will be of the form that we discussed yesterday, where the registers are described by qubits, and so you have, you know, basis states that correspond to strings of some number of bits. And now we're going to have some elementary gates that we allow ourselves to perform. And what I'm saying is, you know, if, for example, we could do a Toffoli gate as one of our elementary quantum gates, and you know, maybe we would also need a NOT gate so that we could set zero bits, you know, turn zero bits into one. So if we allow, say, Toffoli and NOT gates, then we could do a an operation on those registers of qubits that would just be, you know, exactly the operation we talked about doing here reversibly on classical bits, and it would allow us to implement a transformation like this. Yeah. Yes.
So if in order to implement a fanout gate, you use this Toffoli gate, does that somehow allow you to sort of get around the quantum no cloning issue?
No. No. No, it doesn't, unfortunately. So this gets to kind of the next thing that I was going to say something about, which is that so far I'm only talking about what happens when you put in computational basis state inputs, right? So if I put in a computational basis state input, everything behaves, you know, as it did in the classical case, and really nothing is quantum. We're just putting cats around everything. We're not really doing anything. Okay, but now if we have a system which is truly quantum mechanical, we can really think about this as an operation which is defined actually for arbitrary quantum states by linearity. So this acts on arbitrary superpositions of computational basis states by linearity. Okay, and now the way that it acts on superpositions is just you take this operation and you act with it on each of the individual terms in the superposition, decomposing it in the computational basis, and that tells you what the operation does. And of course, that operation may not be what you intuitively are thinking about if you're thinking in the computational basis, if you're thinking about classical transformations. And so the example that you brought up is a good one. We could think about what happens if we take, for example, a CNOT gate, which we said we should think about as reversible copying. Right, so now I'm thinking about this really as a quantum circuit. So if, for example, I put in some computational basis state input, here I put x and here I put y, so I'm putting in some product state, which is either just the state 0, 0, 0, 1, et cetera, the output will indeed be just here I'll get x and here I'll get x plus y. Okay, so that's what we saw from the classical picture. But now if I put in some superposition, so let's say, for example, I put in the following thing. So say I put in 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1 in the first register, and 0 in the second register. So now I'm putting in a product state input still. What do I get as the output? Actually, we have some notation from yesterday that if you remember it, you can use to say what the answer is very quickly. So let's just kind of quickly do the calculation, right? So we have here 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 0. If I were to expand this thing out as a superposition of computational basis states, I just took the tensor product of this state with this state. And now this state maps to 0, 0 under the action of the CNOT gate, and this state maps to 1, 1, right? So what the CNOT gate is going to do is it's going to take this to 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. Right, so this is the state which was called this was called beta 0, 0 yesterday. I mean, it's not important to remember that, but this is one of the states of this thing that's called this basis that we called the Bell basis, which was important in superdense coding, and it also appears in teleportation and other places. So I mean, it's quite an important sort of state to think about in quantum information processing. And it's an entangled state. It's a state that you can't factorize as the product of some state living here and some other state living here. It's just a state which is truly an entangled state of the two qubits. What we have done in this case is not to create two copies of this state, right? The output over here is not a plus state here and a plus state here. It's an entangled state of the two registers. So this reversible copying we can think about as copying in the computational basis, but it's not copying in any basis. And that's the sense in which this doesn't violate the no cloning theorem. Right? So there's a theorem in quantum mechanics, which probably maybe you've seen before, which says that you can't clone arbitrary quantum states. If you're given some unknown quantum state, you can't make two copies of it. That theorem is, of course, respected here. Here's sort of the explanation. What happens when you try to copy is that actually you get an entangled state. Yes? How we got this from this? Okay, so we just looked term by term. So what I said was the action of these circuits on arbitrary superpositions is by linearity. So what I did is I decomposed the state as a sum of computational basis states. So Like, are you okay with this being the input state on the left-hand side? Okay, so then what we did is we just looked term by term. So what you know, what CNOT does is if we have 0, 0, we get as output 0, and 0 plus 0 is 0. So we get out 0, 0. So that's why I wrote 0, 0 here. And for the other term, we have 1, 0, and 1, 0 maps to 1, 1. Right? Yes, if you expand the thing as a superposition of classical basis states and then use linearity, you can get the result. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So I have two questions. So the first one is it possible to make the entanglement state into the Kodak state?
Well, sure. If we wanted, yeah, that's right. If we wanted to send this thing back to this product state, we would just do the gate again. And since it's its own inverse, we would go back to this state. I mean, of course, to do that, we had to have some interaction between the two qubits. This is a gate which interacts the two qubits. And that's something which is certainly necessary to turn an entangled state into an unentangled state. Right? If we had some entangled state and we only did local operations, single qubit unitaries on the two qubits, then the state would stay entangled. Well, I mean, what I would say is that if you try to copy a quantum state using a CNOT gate, which you think of as copying in the computational basis, what you will get as output if you put in some input which is not a computational basis state is in general an entangled state. So that's just what will happen in general, and that's the sense in which the no cloning theorem is respected. Right, can copy all the states of one basis. Yeah, so that's the best you can do. So in general, if you can clone states in a fixed basis. So it could be the computational basis. Of course, you could rotate your basis and clone states in some other basis. But then you would be failing to clone states in some other basis. And it's just not possible. I mean, if you could clone states in two distinct bases, then you could clone arbitrary states. But you can't. So you can't. Kind of sad. Right. I mean, of course, there are other things you can think about. Like, there's this whole notion of approximate cloning. You could ask, like, maybe I can't clone states perfectly, but how well could I do? What's the best? You know, you could have some distance measure on the set of states and try to figure out how well you could do. And there are interesting questions you can ask along those lines. But, you know, you certainly can't do it perfectly. Yeah. OK. So we talked about uncomputation, and then I guess the next thing to talk about is quantum universality. So we're only going to talk about this very briefly, and fortunately you've seen something about this already in yesterday's tutorial. So quantumly, you know, classically we have some notion of universality, which says we would like to be able to compute any function. Okay, but quantumly, our notion of universality might be a bit different because the set of all the operations we can do is not this discrete set. Like, so you know, if we think about all of the functions that map n bits to m bits, then you know that's some discrete set of operations. Of course, it's very large and grows very rapidly as n and m grow, but it's just some discrete set of operations. But quantumly, it's even more complicated. So the set of all of the operations that we can do consist of all the unitary operations on, say, n qubit states, right? So, so to be universal, what we would like to do is to be able to, in principle, do any unitary transformation on n qubits, right? So we would say a set of gates is universal if it can be used to implement any elements of U 2 to the n. So what I mean by that is, I don't remember what the notation that I used for this before was. Maybe the unitary is acting on U C 2 to the n. I guess What I mean is the set of unitary operations acting on 2 to the n by 2 to the n, acting on a complex space of dimension 2 to the n. So 2 to the n by 2 to the n unitaries. Of course, maybe up to some global phase degree of freedom that we don't care about. Okay. So this seems like maybe it's a taller order than what we had in the classical case. I mean, in the classical case, we just had some discrete set of operations to do. But now we have some actually continuous set of operations to do. But nevertheless, it turns out that there are some fairly simple sets of universal gates. So for example, if we take the C0 gate, and we add the set of all single qubit gates, this is a universal set. So this is not something that we're going to prove here, but it's something that you could maybe think about. And for example, if you want to read about why this fact is true, it's explained both in the Nielsen and Chuang textbook, which is a good resource, and also the Kayla Flom-Mosca textbook, which is another one I would recommend for background for this course. So, if you take just this one two-qubit operation, so, you know, the C0 gate, which acts like this on computational basis states and is defined on arbitrary states by linearity, and then now you allow this infinite set of arbitrary single-qubit gates, so just any element of U2, so anything acting on, any 2x2 unitary matrix, you allow that as an elementary gate, then in principle, you can write any unitary transformation at all, which might act collectively on all of the n qubits, as some product of C0 gates and single qubit gates. Okay. So this is a good thing to know, and it sort of seems nice. But there's something which is a little bit unappealing about this, which is that actually we have an infinite set of gates, right? So to describe what computation we might be doing, we have to specify gates that come from this infinite set. So we would have to say where we do the C0 gates, and we would also have to say where we do the single qubit gates. But to describe the individual single qubit gates, we would have to specify, axes that we rotate about and angles that we rotate by to arbitrary precision. And this is really not so good. But this is an infinite set of gates. And this causes problems, so for example, we couldn't have a finite specification of what an algorithm is. We would have to specify angles to arbitrary precision. It also causes problems, for example, when we talk about fault tolerance. So to have a well-defined notion of fault-tolerant computation, it's quite important to have a discrete set of gates, and we'll see something about this later on. So this is something that we would like to get rid of, but it seems like we're stuck because, we're trying to do gates that come from some infinite set of operations. So if we want to be able to do them exactly, there's just no getting around the fact that we need to have access to some infinite set of operations. So you have a question?
It sounds like you say this is a problem because the single qubit gates from an infinite set.
Right.
And that specifying a gate would involve arbitrary precision.
Right. I see. So you're saying, like, maybe you would be happy if there was only a countable set of operations. Maybe we could perform rotations by arbitrary angles, but coming from not completely arbitrary angles, but coming from some countable set.
I was actually wondering if I'm probably saying this wrong. It seems to me that the problem is but this is an infinite set of gates. It looks to me like the problem is not so much that this is an infinite set of gates, but this is a
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just trying to rephrase what you're saying, right? I mean, how could you have some infinite set that doesn't actually form a continuum? I mean, you could have some countable infinite set, right, where you have some discrete set of points. I mean, that seems like it's the other option, right? But you would still need infinitely many bits to specify what it is. Now, that would be maybe a little bit better, but it would still be kind of problematic because you probably still wouldn't be able to do things exactly, because here we have some uncountable set of operations that we want to do, and if you only have some countable set of gates and then you compose them in some countable way, you're only ever going to describes some countable set of operations that you can do. So in particular, you won't be able to exactly do all of these gates. Okay, but you know, we can get around this problem by relaxing a little bit our notion of what we mean by universal. And this will, you know, we won't even have to worry about this situation where we have countable sets of gates, and we can really have small discrete sets of gates, just including some constant number of gates. You know, like we just have maybe three gates that we know how to do, and if we can do those on any of the qubits in any way we choose, then it will be universal, but in a slightly relaxed sense. So we won't have to really, you know, we'll sort of sidestep the issue that you're asking about. So what we'll do is, so consider instead a notion of approximate universality. And you saw, so you saw something about this already on the in the first tutorial, I think. So what we mean by this is that we'll say that a set of gates is approximately universal if any unitary acting on, you know, the n qubits that we might care about can be epsilon approximated by gates from the given set. Okay. So of course, when we say epsilon approximated, we have to have some notion of approximation. So we have to have some distance measure on unitary operations. And you know, there are different measures you could choose, and we'll talk more carefully about distance measures on quantum states, and they would then you know. So quantum operations would then inherit some distance measure from some distance measure that you might put on quantum states. And we'll talk about those kinds of things later on. But for now, let me just say one kind of measure that we could use. So we could say that you know, U epsilon approximates V if it's the case that the spectral norm of the difference of U and V, okay, which is just the max overall quantum state psi of the length of the vector U minus V psi, is at most epsilon. So this kind of says no matter what quantum state you throw at the two unitaries, you get something which is close to the same answer, right? So you get, you know, if you take the difference of those two quantum states, you get something which is small, if epsilon is something small. So this kind of notion of distance at least has the property that as you take epsilon to 0, it must be that U goes to V. So it's some kind of reasonable notion of approximation. Okay, so now what we could say is that you know, we could have some set of gates which is approximately universal. And that means not that we can implement any operation exactly, but just that we can epsilon approximate it. And this will be good enough for our purposes as long as we can do this for any arbitrarily small epsilon that we might choose. So yeah, I guess I should have put that in the definition of universality. So we don't say it's epsilon approximately universal, right? We just say that it's approximately universal. So so what I should write here is for any epsilon greater than 0. So we can make epsilon as small as we want. Of course, to make epsilon smaller, we might have to use more gates. But we're not talking about notions of efficiency right now. We're just talking about notions of universality. So maybe you can't do the unitary you would like to do exactly, but you can get as close as you like. So for any positive epsilon, you can find something which satisfies this condition. Okay. So I guess the last thing that I should say is just that you can find sets of gates which are universal in this sense. So there are finite sets of approximately universal gates. And you saw something that was in this direction in the first tutorial. So you know, of course, now to see that we have some finite set of universal gates, we saw that the, you know, the non-finiteness of the universal set really came entirely from the action of the gates of the single qubit gates. You know, here we had some set of arbitrary single qubit gates, but only one 2-qubit gate. The C0 gate. And so if we could just show some set of single qubit gates that would allow us to implement any you know, any unitary acting on a single qubit, epsilon approximately, then what we would get would be a universal set, so an approximately universal set acting on any number of qubits. And so there's one very common set of gates that people often take, which consists of, so first of all, the C0 gate, the Hadamard gate, which is something that we saw before. So this is 1 over root 2, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And what's called the pi over 8 gate, often denoted T. And this is the gate, the diagonal gate, so 1, 0, 0, e to the I pi over 4. Now, you might be scratching your head a little bit. Why do we call this the pi over 8 gate when there's a pi over 4 here? Well, it's because, you know, if you were to pull out some global phase of, you know, e to the I pi over 8, then this would be e to the minus I pi over 8, e to the I pi over 8. So that's why this thing is sometimes called the pi over 8 gate. So this is a universal set of gates, an approximately universal set of gates. So if I have the ability to implement these gates on any qubits that I like, so I can do a C0 gate between any two gates that I like, where either of them can be the target and either can be the control, and I can put the Hadamard anywhere I want, and I can put the T gate anywhere I want, then in principle, I can get I can epsilon approximate any gate that I might like. So now what we can do is we can draw quantum circuits, and we can we can use them potentially to come up with algorithms. So we have some symbols that we use to represent these gates. We draw a C0 gate like this, just as we did when we were talking about reversible computation. We draw a Hadamard gate like this, just an H in a box, and a T gate like this, just we write T in a box. And so we could draw quantum circuits, like, for example, we could do a C0 gate, and then we could do a Hadamard gate, and then we could do a T gate. And we'll draw things like this in order to represent quantum computations that we might carry out, decomposed into elementary gates. And then what we can do at the end of the day is count up the gates, and that will tell us something about how hard it was to do the computation. Okay. Questions? Yes?
So are these three gates enough to do any infinitesimal rotation?
Yes. Yes. So you
think for these three gates, I can't see that. For example, the T gate, it is the rotation along.
By a big angle.
C-axis. Right.
Right.
How do you do that?
So I think you saw something about this in the first tutorial, right? So that problem is certainly relevant to this question. I think we're at the end of the hour, so maybe we could just talk about it a little bit afterward. It's not obvious, right? Because it looks like we're doing these big rotations, and how could we somehow approximate well some arbitrary operation, which could potentially be a rotation by a very small angle. You have to think about the ways that you could combine these gates, and let's just talk about it afterwards. And I think maybe I can help you. But yeah, it's certainly not surprising. And so, for example, you know, a consequence of this is that there's some way of writing the Toffoli gate just using these gates, right? Because that's some other gate we might try to approximate, and so there's some way of writing it just using these gates, or at least of approximating it. Actually, I'm not sure off the top of my head if you can do it exactly using these gates. That would be something to try to do. So you could try to implement a Toffoli gate, you know, using a C0 gate and H and T gates, and there's a way to do it well, at least approximately. And so that says that, you know, whereas in the classical case you need these 3-bit gates, so you can show that if you only have 2-bit reversible gates, there's no way to have a universal set. Quantumly, it actually suffices to only have 2-qubit gates, because in particular you could use these gates to approximate the Toffoli gate. But you would certainly do that by leaving the space of computational basis states. You would be kind of going elsewhere in Hilbert space. Sorry, that was a long answer to a short question. Are there other questions? Okay, great. So thanks. So see you tomorrow.